From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, in the past five centuries, we've witnessed the greatest expansion of civilization in human history, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. Social, political, economic, and cultural revolutions were made possible by the discovery of unprecedented natural abundance in the form of soils, minerals, waters, forests, and biota in the New World.
In the book Shrinking the Earth, acclaimed historian Donald Worster examines how issues of scarcity and abundance have shaped American society. It's a fascinating look at the limits nature imposes on human ambitions. Ultimately, Worster argues, our era of expansion is coming to an end as a result of ecological scarcity and vulnerability is taking its place.
Donald Worster joins us in the first part of the show. Then in the second half, Nell and I will cover a couple of news items, including an interesting study published last week on the Pacific garbage patch. We're all kind of familiar with that. Well, the one takeaway is that it's not garbage. It's just plastic and lots and lots and lots of it. And it's circling around in the Pacific Ocean, and they have some interesting findings about what makes up that plastic, how it's formed, and of course the impacts of it and what we can do about it. We don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our email address, thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
Hi, this is Steve Roney, owner of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. I'm a proud resident of Park City and a loyal supporter of KPCW and all it does for our community. Our agents in Summit and Wasatch counties can be reached at any of our 30 offices or at our website, bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first half of the show today is Donald Worster. He's the honorary director of the Center for Ecological History at the University of Renmin of China and Hall Distinguished Professor of American History Emeritus at the University of Kansas. Today he's here to talk about his book, Shrinking the Earth, The Rise and Decline of Natural Abundance. Donald, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Well, you know, when we're talking about environmental issues, we don't usually get very literary. So I think it might surprise some people that the beginning of your book is about the Great Gatsby and your theory of the green light. And so why don't you start by telling us about that?
Yeah, well, that book is not normally read as an environmental fable, but I think that is essentially what it is. Gatsby is described in the book as walking down the lawn towards Long Island Sound and seeing a green light in the distance. It's obviously a boat dock, but he sees in it a kind of green light shining out of the New World. And the book ends with this image of the discovery of the Americas, the Western Hemisphere, back in the hundreds of years earlier, and how it filled people with a dream and hope and so forth. And I think and that things had gone wrong. By the time the Gatsby book was written, Fitzgerald didn't think that that green world existed in the way it once had. It had been diminished. And so that's really the story. Gatsby's story is his death and so forth is at the center of it. But the broader meaning is what's happened to that American dream based on unlimited abundance of nature.
And so obviously, when the Americas were first discovered, there was that unlimited abundance and unlimited opportunity for those who arrived here to take advantage of abundance, like you describe, in terms of land and sea and animals and farming opportunities. It was all there for them, and they all took advantage of it, and everything seemed to start out quite well.
Yes, that's true. There was a reality there, but there was also a dream that was extravagant and beyond measuring. I mean, the New World had its limits. It had its limits very early when you look at a place like Nantucket and the whaling industry. New England had its limits. But, and as people went west, of course, they'd encounter more and more limits, limited rainfall beyond the Rockies, beyond the Great Plains. So there were always limits there, but there was always a promise that there was more over the next hill.
Right. So, okay. So how and kind of when did this dream get started? I mean, these European explorers were maybe living in cramped cities. There were scarce resources. How did this dream sort of gain a foothold?
Well, people had dreamed of a heaven somewhere, a place of unlimited abundance and ease and comfort for a long, long time, since the Garden of Eden, I suppose. So there's that old dream, not only in the West, but I think throughout the world. But most people's experience, this is, I think, the story of Genesis, is one of hard work, toil, labor, and scarcity. And by the time you get to Christopher Columbus, Europe is feeling a pinch. It has adjusted to it, but it is feeling a pinch. It's looking for new ways to escape its fate. So Christopher Columbus sails off hoping that China will be the answer. What he didn't realize as he started off, that there's a whole Western Hemisphere, two oceans and two continents standing in the way. But that discovery, which could only happen once in all of human history in terms of European society or even Chinese society, the advanced civilizations, could only happen once in history, and it just had profound revolutionary impact on people. This isn't just a dream of heaven. This is a dream of the here and now. We can go there. We can live there. We can exploit its resources. Of course, we have to disregard the native peoples living there already, but we can do it.
And I guess, do we still maintain that mindset today, even in the face of finite resources and reduced resources in one form or another?
Well, I think in a general sense, yes, we do. Americans in particular.
Yeah.
And probably other peoples in the Western Hemisphere to some extent. More so, I think, than people in China, where I spend part of my year. They know what scarcity is. They've been there for a long, long time, pushing up against limits and having to work really, really hard to overcome them. But Americans still, to a large extent, feel we live in the land of plenty and abundance. There's always room for more. We can just find it somewhere else. We don't have to fight over it. We don't have to argue and take it away from somebody else down the street. Of course, over the last few decades, that perception has been changing. And this is really the thrust of my book, is that we are going through a profound cultural change in the United States and, in a sense, across the world, that says that we are back to where we were, you could say, in 1500, in a world of scarce resources, limits, and particularly, depends on how you define limits here, not just scarce this or scarce that, but a general sense that the earth is quite vulnerable to our demands.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention China. Let's talk a little bit about that, the differences you see in, I guess, Chinese culture and their perspective on resources and consumption versus the Americans' perspective.
Well, China's been around for many thousands of years, much longer than the United States. It has always, for several thousand years at least, counted one-fourth or one-fifth of the world's population. So the Chinese had been familiar with people pressing against land and resources. For a long time, they also expanded into their frontier lands. But by the time you get to, say, 1800, there's not much expansion possibility left. And the story of the China since, well, the time of the American Revolution has been one of dire scarcity and poverty. Revolutionaries came along and tried to break China out of that, but it's really only been in the last 30 years that the Chinese have said, we can break out of this if we can just adopt the Western ideas, Western mm-hmm. technology, capitalism, you know, all of this science. We'll get ourselves out of it. But I think there is a long memory there that that the Chinese are never very far from scarcity. There's a kind of realism about the earth, and I see it working right now in many ways in China in terms of energy policies. But they are on a global search for natural resources now that looks very much like how Americans have been thinking. But when I talk to people in China, I think there's a greater realism in the sense that the earth has its limits that they've been aware of for a long time.
And maybe they fashion their dreams and their desires and their wants around those limits, recognizing that maybe their dreams and desires have limits too.
Well, insofar as China remains a peasant-based society, and to a large extent it is still that. That is the case. I think peasants always have a sense of, you know,
yeah.
promises can be made, but there's the reality I have to face each day. I'm living on 1 acre of land, and I've got 6 kids and, you know, to support. So that's an old reality. The new businessmen, the new capitalists of China are probably more like those who sit in Wall Street or San Francisco or Tokyo. You know, they think they can solve every problem with technology.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, switching gears a little bit, you referenced Nantucket a few minutes ago,
right.
And I want to circle back to that because it is an interesting story and maybe a little bit of a microcosm or a parable for what we're seeing on a larger scale. Will you tell that story of Nantucket?
Well, it's the subject of a whole chapter. Let's see if I can boil it down. Nantucket's the story that, although Americans are familiar with it and romanticize it, it's the story of an America that we don't like to celebrate because it's a story of, to a large extent, expansion, over-exploitation, collapse. That is the story of Nantucket, collapse of an entire economy, a population, depopulation that follows. It's just a little sandy, you know, spit of land out there off the Massachusetts shore, which had very little agricultural potential. So the only way that the Europeans could make a living there was to follow the Native Americans and try to exploit the whales. And, of course, that led to the whole whaling industry in the Atlantic and the Pacific. But it began to collapse even before we discovered oil in Pennsylvania. It began to collapse, this whale oil economy. And for a long time, Nantucket did not know what to do with itself. It was a ghost town.
Hmm.
We have lots of ghost towns across America based on this kind of exploitation of resources, mining towns.
Park City is an old yeah. ghost town in yeah. that sense for a while.
And yeah, Aspen and so on, silver towns and copper towns. You can say there's life beyond collapse. You have to find a whole new use. In Nantucket, they basically became a resort colony for super rich people from New York City who brought money, who brought resources to the place. That's essentially unsustainable probably over the long run, but that's the Nantucket we know and see today. But the story is really one that people just were not ready for. And they came out to this little island from the mainland of Massachusetts, wondering what we could do here. They tried this, they tried that, and then they hit on the bonanza, and they went crazy. And in a few decades, the bonanza was heavily depleted. The whales weren't all gone, but it was really hard to find them. So there's a story there that we ought to think about when we go there as tourists and admire the old cobblestone streets and the whaling docks and so forth. It was a town that self-destructed.
Right. And cod also played a role, too, up and down New England coast. And that has a similar arc to that story, a tremendous abundance of fish that was exploited first by European countries coming over to Nova Scotia and the eastern east coast of the U.S., and where the cod used to be literally caught just offshore. You know, they were overfished with larger and more boats until the cod effectively and the industry collapsed under that same overfishing.
Yeah, they have a codfish, wooden codfish hanging in the Massachusetts State Legislative Chamber as a symbol of what made them great and the promise of nature. But the cod fisheries of Boston today, are, as you say, a warning to us. This has happened with species after species of plant and animals across our continent, but we don't think of that as failure. We just thought we would move on with bringing cows and so forth, but, you know, even the things that we bring in can be depleted and those ecologies collapse.
Sure. The same thing. I'm sorry. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with David Worster.
He's Donald.
Donald.
I knew I was going to say Dave. Oh, I'm sorry. Donald Worster, the author.
Think Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Donald Worster, the author of Shrinking the Earth. And you know, just another example of in the fishing industry, there's so many. The tuna industry also is slowly, if not even more accelerating, witnessing a collapse around the world as the consumption of it grows and grows and the appetite for it continues. So many examples of fish where we, like you say, Donald, we just move on to the next fish, but we're working our way down the fish food chain to where now, you know, chefs in Japan are trying to figure out how we can eat jellyfish because that seems to be what comes up in the nets of a lot of fishermen. And so example of exploitation, overconsumption. Sorry.
And what is new in this picture, I think, is that we're beginning to have a sense through natural science, earth science, a broader earth science, that the planet itself is in a diminished state. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by shrinking the Earth. Its capacity to support life is under threat through climate change, through so many biodiversity change, a whole list of categories in which we are moving into a state of instability. So it's not just that we deplete this resource and that one. I think the more important thing we've learned is that we can undermine ecosystems and their ability to support life.
So now that, you know, we're starting to come to this realization that the earth and natural resources are not boundless or limitless, what, you know, what next? What are the kinds of changes you're starting to see, these cultural changes you're referencing?
Well, you have to go back and, I think, look at the social, political, economic consequences of the discovery of the Americas. That's the first step. I think that's what my book really tries to get historians to think about, because they have not done so. They go looking at the Industrial Revolution, and maybe they talk about coal, but by and large, they almost never acknowledge how much the discovery of the Western Hemisphere changed Europe and therefore changed world civilization in a whole series of revolutions, including capitalism, the scientific revolution, industrialization, democracy. So if we are reaching the end of that 500-year expansion, then I think we'll start seeing changes in those what once were revolutionary changes going on. We'll see changes in capitalism. We'll see changes in the way in which businessmen begin to think about resources, sustainability. We'll begin to see changes in our international relations. The status of the United States may not be what it once was when we had a greater natural abundance at our fingertips. We'll see changes perhaps in the role of science in society. are changing from one of trying to help us exploit resources as fast as we can to one of trying to steward and maintain those resources and ecosystems. Are any of those changes taking place right now? Well, I think you can see evidence of them in many ways, but I'm not your, you know, as a prophet to tell you where those are going to go or what the outcome will be, except to say that I think we are at the end of a 500-year period of revolution, revolutionary change in the relationship of people to the earth, and we might want to try to steer it in humane and good ways, but we need to start thinking about how we can change and what will make sense given the new realities.
I loved the way that you put it in the book. You know, you talked about the impact of the discovery of the Western Hemisphere. It was almost like this discovery of a second world. But our chances at this point of finding another nature, another hemisphere of such easy abundance, you know, those chances are zero now. And it's obviously a very simple concept, but it's maybe one, you know, worth pointing out and talking about, that we need to think differently about the resources that we have now, because we are not going to suddenly come upon another wealth of resources.
Well, that's a controversial reading. It's my reading, and you've summarized it quite clearly, but it's controversial because there are people out there in science, technology, who in business, who think, you know, we'll transcend this earth. We'll go someplace else. I mean, the late Steve Hawking thought this was the case. You know, we are mucking up the earth, he said, and we've got to start thinking about outer space as a place to go. But as far as I can see, there's no technology available now and probably unlikely for a long time to come that will allow us to migrate en masse to another planet. And that's likely to be, if we ever find such a place, far outside our solar system, in solar systems, you know, millions of light years away, perhaps. So, you know, the practical truth is that while that might be an interesting idea to explore, it doesn't seem to me to be of any immediate practical value.
Right. I agree. Okay. There's a reason why there isn't life on Mars or on the moon or other planets, because it doesn't support it, you know. And you're right. We have to go there and artificially create a support system, which is a tremendous venture. While right here on the planet, you know, there's probably so much of the our seas and our lands we still don't understand on this planet and still have to learn. I want to go back to, you talked about changes in policy, changes in technology. What role do you think that changes in our behavior? Again, if our dreams and aspirations are by and large carbon-based in one way or another, then maybe we need to shift those dreams and aspirations away from being carbon-based and learn to live with a little less.
Yes, and certainly to find ways to get more out of what remains. There are several kinds of changes that I think are needed here. One is the change in our attitude towards reproduction and fertility.
Right.
This has been taken off the table by even many environmental organizations because it's so unpopular. But in fact, I think we can see changes taking place there at the grassroots that would surprise demographers of some years ago. There are prognostications that by the middle of this century, we will reach a tabling off of world population and fertility. I think it's much more likely that we'll reach a point where population will begin to go down. And it's very likely that in 100 or 200 years, we may see a dramatic downward spiral in human populations. That seems to be much more likely than some kind of steady state for the next 10,000 years. So that's a change that we can talk about, we can actually see, and it's taking place because of changes in women's roles and education, environmental attitudes, et cetera. The cost of college is another factor. But That's one. But so the question I think we're really facing now is, can we see such a shift, a change, and see it fast enough in terms of consumption as well? Consumption of resources and our impact on ecosystems through consumption. And that remains to be seen. When do people say, you know, not just that one child or two children is enough, but also one car is enough.
Right.
Or we don't even need a car.
Or in the case of Park City, one house is enough.
One house.
All right?
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe one vacation is enough a year, because all of these have a carbon, there's a carbon footprint. That's kind of the third rail topic out here in Park City when we talk about vacation, because this is a vacation town. So
yeah,
those are challenges here we face in this town. So yeah, lots of examples. And you know, Donald, we haven't even talked about India, because I always like to look at India as the next big consumer of resources and carbon, and they have lots of challenges there, simply trying to provide basic infrastructure to now over a billion people in that country.
Yeah, they're a lot more scary, I think, environmentally than China is.
Huh.
The population of India is going to surpass China's in a very short time.
Right.
There's been almost no effort, real effort, to change behavior there. Whereas in China, they're following the profile of Japan these days pretty closely and seeing dropping fertility rates. But India and infrastructure planning, China overdoes it, blows a lot of money foolishly on projects, but it is also putting a lot of money into a new energy system and mass transportation and things that, well, I just don't see this happening in India. I've only been to India once, but it was in some ways a nightmare experience.
Right.
People are beautiful and the country is gorgeous, but I didn't see any real environmental awareness and broad spread and so on. So, you know, that's got to be something that worries all of us, all over the earth.
Right, right. Again, we're speaking with Donald Worster. He's the author of Shrinking the Earth. It's now available out in paperback. Donald, we got a few more minutes. I wanted to talk about, if you're willing, to talk about some of the other books you've written, because some of them,
sure,
a lot of them have a Western theme to it. You wrote The Life of John Muir, a book, A River Running West, The Life of John Wesley Powell. Great, amazing, amazing man, environmentalist. And Under Western Skies, Nature and History in the American West. What is it about individuals or the American West that draws you to write about it?
Well, I'm living in Oregon now, but I grew up in Southern California, Mojave Desert, and on the Great Plains. And so I've grown up all my life as a Westerner and as concerned about land and water issues. I wrote a book called Rivers of Empire, which is about water in the American West. I wrote a book on the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, mm-hmm, the Great Plains. I came to those biographies pretty late because I felt that I was, I don't know, getting a little too generalized, you know. I needed to really get down and see the complexity of the individual. And, you know, otherwise we're just statistics. And I don't think historians understand society very well unless they really dive into the individual life and tried to explain how people develop. I thought both John Wesley Powell and John Muir were incredible. They had very, very similar personal backgrounds,
mm-hmm,
even living for a while within, you know, 50, 60 miles from one another, I think. But yet they grew up to be very different kinds of people. Both came out west in about the same time, 1868. One went to Yosemite Valley, the other through the Grand Canyon, but they both became profound influences on American environmental thinking. But they were very different people, despite their similar backgrounds. I was curious to see how that had happened, but also to see, you know, the American environmental movement, where does it come from? In some ways, it stems from those two people to a large extent.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm in love with Western landscapes and the Western culture and I taught Western history, the history of the American West and frontier for many, many years. So those are my roots. And so the latest book comes from going international, I guess, and spending a lot of time outside the United States. But my roots really still lie here in the American West.
Right.
And you've also written about the Dust Bowl. Which I thought was sort of another interesting story with some parallels to Shrinking the Earth, kind
right.
of this story of our impacts on the environment and then the huge consequences that that can have.
Yes, well, I think the feeling on the Great Plains is that, well, we solved that problem. You know, we'll never go through that again. And that may be the case. Problems don't always occur exactly in the same way, but through climate change, man-made climate change, it seems to me we are recreating some of the very conditions that created the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. So there's something to be concerned about there.
Right. Yeah, we only have a few more minutes. You've been writing, covering environmental issues for decades now, Donald. And in this book, are you hopeful? Do you see? I think you suggested that in some of the conversation here. You do see changes afoot, or coming about, maybe in this next generation or so. But overall, are you hopeful that we may get it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I am. Yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm not particularly optimistic. Mm-hmm. There's a difference here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hopeful in that I think there are. We have the capacity, historically, I mean, first and foremost, I'm a historian. I mean, I'm not really an analyst of current environmental issues or a policymaker and so on, but I think when we look back historically, you have to say there's hope because people have been through all kinds of disasters, tragedies, limits, and so forth. And we not only have survived, but we've over-survived. I mean, there's 7 billion of us now.
Right.
So we have made huge changes, including the changes that have given us the modern world. And I call it capitalist modernity, but it's, you know, we invented things that have brought great benefits to people. And if they don't work anymore, then, well, we can change them.
Right.
If we invented them in the first place, we can change them. So that part of me is the hope, the basis of hope.
Right.
I'm 76 years old, so I guess I'm supposed to be cranky and pessimistic about everything at this point in my life, but I actually feel a little more hopeful than I did back in the 60s and 70s.
All right, well, we're encouraged, too.
That's right.
By your words also,
good.
Donald. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much for joining us. That is Donald Worster, author of Shrinking the Earth, The Rise and Decline of Natural Abundance. Thanks so much for joining us, Donald.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. All right, let's take a quick break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we got a couple of items to cover in the news about, well, not so hopeful, Arctic sea ice and the Pacific plastic patch. It's new name. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
This is Travis Vernon, fly fishing coordinator of JANS and longtime supporter of KPCW. Our fly fishing department and guide service is open year-round and offers a full line of flies and product, including brands like Sims, Sage, and Fishpond. We also rent rods, reels, and waders. Available at the flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or JANS.com.
Hi, this is Bill Rock. The Vail Epic Promise Foundation, a nonprofit organization, is a proud supporter of KPCW. The foundation provides Park City Mountain employees with grants in emergencies and for educational purposes. Information is available to Park City Mountain employees at epicpromise.com.
Dr. Bob Miller here from Miller Orthodontics, proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton, who makes us all smile. Embrace is a technology to straighten teeth without anything showing. More information about Embrace is at myembrace.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we've talked about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's turning into almost an island out there.
Of sorts. Yes.
We've talked about this before. You're ready to rename it, Chris.
I am, based on a report that was published last week in the journal Scientific Reports. In summary, it quantifies the full extent of the so-called Pacific Garbage Patch. Here's some of the numbers. Based on this study, it is 4 to 16 times, that's a big range, 4 to 16 times larger than previously thought, occupying an area roughly four times the size of California.
That is mind-boggling to me. That's enormous.
Four times, it's almost, well, not quite the entire West.
At what point does this become like, you know, a problem for shipping and transport?
Yeah, exactly. At what point? That's a good question. It compromises or comprises an estimated 1.8 trillion pieces of rubbish. Now, while the patch was once thought to be more akin to a soup of nearly invisible microplastics, scientists now think most of the trash consists of larger pieces. And they say it's growing exponential growth of this garbage or so. It says Laurent Le Breton, who is the oceanographer with the Ocean Cleanup Foundation, which did this survey study. It's just quite alarming, he says, because you are so far from the mainland. There's no one around, and you still see these common objects like crates and bottles. And what was Jeff McCarthy talking about last week? You're right.
I was just going to say the same thing. Last week, writer and director of the Environmental Humanities Program at the University
and
of Utah.
And sailor,
apparently, was talking about his experience sailing from Maine to Bermuda. And he noted the same thing. You wouldn't see a person or another boat for days.
And what did they say?
What did they count?
Balloons. Kids' balloons floating around in the water.
Yeah.
So it's all out there. But what's interesting is that in this study, which was conducted late summer of 2015, they measured the amount of plastic debris in the patch by trawling it with nets and flying overhead to take aerial photographs. Though they found glass and rubber and wood, 99.9% of what the researchers pulled out of the ocean was plastic. That's why this should be named the Pacific Plastic Patch, not the Garbage Patch. This is a plastic patch. They also recovered a startling number of abandoned fishing nets, which are plastic, made of plastic because of their resiliency. These ghost nets made up almost half of the total weight of the debris they collected.
Wow.
Yeah, one explanation is the patch's proximity to fishing grounds, of course. Another is that these fishing material, these nets, are designed to be resilient and stay intact longer than other objects. Years and years and years, they'll stay intact and they'll float around. And not only will they, you know, break down and then be nibbled on by animals like, for example, turtles or birds or stuff, but they're still actively catching fish. They still act as a net. That's what they do. They catch fish. So there's a combined problem here with all these fishing nets that are floating about in this plastic patch. We found a few unexpected objects, Mr. Le Breton said. Among them were plastic toys, which they probably assume could be remnants of the tsunami that occurred in Japan back in 2011. And also cargo ships that drop there, that lose containers and open up. There have been stories of that,
sure.
Sneakers and rubber ducks and things like that, and toys that are released from these cargo containers. So that's here's another interesting thing. The consequence, for example, some sea turtles caught near the patch were eating so much plastic that it made up around 3/4 of their diet. So their stomachs are full of these of plastic, small bits of plastic that they're tricked into thinking that is food.
It's food, yeah, and that's something that's been an issue I know with seabirds and shorebirds as well, is they can't sort of get the nutrition they need because their stomach will be full of these plastic scraps.
Right. So the new study says that microplastics, while still a problem, account for just 8% of the mass of this patch. Until now, most of the sampling used an ocean trawl designed to pick up small particles, and therefore, Mr. Le Breton said, underestimated the number of large pieces of debris floating in the sea, again, like bottles, buoys, and fishing nets. So,
and despite the enormous size and amount of trash in this Great Pacific Plastic Patch, there's still some question about where the rest of it is going. So some scientists did some research in order to look at, okay, how much plastic do we think is ending up in the ocean? And they were actually surprised by how little was in the patch. And that then begs the question, where is the rest of it going? Is it all degrading into microplastics, as right. you mentioned? Is it being eaten? Is it settling to the
down.
Bottom of the ocean?
Is so it washing ashore?
You know, to be determined. There's still more research to be done on this and kind of what those impacts are.
But again, obviously, consequences of our actions that we think, how's it possible? How's it possible that we could put so much plastic into such a large area in the middle of nowhere, effectively,
yeah.
in the Pacific? Well, it is. It's possible because of the amount of plastics that we generate, the amount of plastics that get washed into our streams and rivers and then washed in out into the ocean, and the time that this has been going on for decades. So it has an impact. And so we do what we can, right?
Hopefully,
we change our behaviors
and
control the amount of plastics that we consume, the amount of plastics that we let get away from us, and try to recycle and reuse and repurpose. And we actually have a story about that, some efforts to reuse and upcycle plastic bags. And, hey, let's get to that story.
Yeah.
Next.
So the snow just melted here in Park City, and suddenly all of the litter and the trash from the winter becomes visible. I think that we could start our own local reuse program right here in Park City with the amount of plastic bags.
And we're going to get to that
on the
story.
Side of the road.
Let's take another quick break, and we'll get to that story. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Hey, welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And we're talking a couple of stories here about the plastic patch. It should be renamed. It's not a garbage patch. It's not garbage. Well, it's garbage, but it's 99.9% of it.
The paper goes away, the cardboard.
Paper, the wood,
yep.
The glass settles out. And in fact, that's organic matter, too. It breaks down over time. Plastic does not. So this is the Pacific Plastic Patch. But here's something. So a couple of University of Utah students had an idea of how they can turn plastic bags into, are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
A comfortable sleeping mat. This is interesting. University of Utah students had the answer at the Clean Air Solutions Fair. They collect plastic bags and then cut and tie them into plastic yarn, or what they call plarn. And I think we've heard about this, about some efforts to turn plastic into
mm-hmm.
a yarn.
Yeah, there were a group of knitters that were knitting products out of
That's what fleece,
yarn.
A lot of fleece is plastic, mm-hmm. resin, plastic resin. The plarn is then crocheted into 3-foot by 6-foot insulating sleeping mats. These mats are amazingly thick and soft. The students are making them to distribute to homeless people who often sleep on cold, hard surfaces. He said, we spoke with one satisfied customer. They really work. They also have the potential to remove thousands of plastic bags from the waste stream. That's great. So you can. So right now, this is down at the University of Utah. You drop off your bags, your plastic bags, like supermarket bags type of thing. at the Benin Center on the first floor of the University of Utah Student Union Building, etc. But what a great idea.
How can we get a hold of these plastic mats? I mean, let's take this beyond the homeless population.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And let's see if we can't do it up here. We're going to see if we can't find these students. And get them on the show. Look at them.
Get them on the air. Look at those smiling faces. We're looking at a photo of them.
Yeah. So this is a great idea to turn plastic bags into plarn and then crochet it. Take some skill.
All right.
I don't have that.
Me either.
All right. We'll find somebody who can crochet over at Recycle Utah and turn it into sleeping mats. All right. So that's the plastic update.
That's the good news. That's from the hopeful local thing. That's right. This
that
is
Donald
what's happening.
Hopefully he hears that. He can be more hopeful because we are. So, all right, let's take another break, and we got a couple last stories. It's the Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Quarterly Summit Community Power Works reports during this Green Earth is brought to you in part by Rocky Mountain Power. Being energy efficient is good for you and the Wasatch Back. Being mindful of how you use energy makes our community better. More information on how to make a difference at wattsmart.com.
All right, we got a couple more news items, or two. We got a few more minutes here. And one of my favorite topics, because it's so emblematic of what is going on with climate change and a warming planet and the consequences of our actions in warming the planet. In this case, the Arctic and Arctic sea ice. Well, here's the latest. The maximum extent of Arctic sea ice cover this winter was the second lowest since satellite record keeping began. These are researchers who study this every day at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. Okay, the loss of sea ice is a bellwether of global warming, suggesting that climate change is not just something to worry about far off in the future, like we did back in 2002 or 2003.
That's
or
right.
When we first started this show.
Yeah.
It's like, well, this is going to happen. We better, you know, this is going to happen in like 10 or 15. Well, you know what? It's 10 or 15 years later, and it's happening. It's here. With each passing decade, the ice grows a bit less in winter and melts a bit more in summer. The record for the least amount of sea ice gained in the winter was set last year when the ice covered 5.57 million square miles. This winter's maximum extent was slightly greater, slightly, at 5.59 million square miles. That's barely, you know, that's basically the same. It's a plus or minus factor in there. Despite the small increase this year, the downward trend in winter ice coverage is unmistakable, and the past 4 years have been the four lowest on record. So there's
not
the
a surprising trend.
No, not a surprising trend, as we see it. And we're going to see that trend probably more than likely, continue throughout the course of this year as they measure as the ice starts to melt through spring and summer. And we'll probably see very, very low amounts of ice during the summer, too. So we'll keep you posted,
that's right,
as we always do, from the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder.
That's right. We have, we have a couple minutes left.
Yes.
We are heading into April, of course, which is Earth Month, the home of Earth Day.
Yes.
And so wanted to share with you some of the events that are coming up around town.
Okay.
Recycle Utah has an Earth Day dinner on Sunday, April 22nd, on Earth Day itself, from 5 to 8 p.m. It's a celebration of our beautiful Earth and the work that Recycle Utah does to protect it.
Right.
This is also a fundraiser, so tickets are $35 each for adult and $15 for children. Or it's $40 at the door. And
where is this being held again?
So I believe it's at Wasatch. Yeah, it's at Wasatch Brew Pub.
Okay.
So you can sign up for that. And then also toward the end of the month is the household hazardous waste collection.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're doing your spring cleaning, set those things aside and make sure you get them to the hazardous waste collection. That's on April 28th in the Canyons parking lot. And there is always a hazardous waste drop-off at the landfill. We like to remind people you have that option as well. Don't just throw it in the trash if you don't want to hang on to it.
Right.
You know, you don't have to wait for 6 months until the next hazardous household collection. But if you want to wait till there's an option right here in town, you can do that.
And you can always drop off your used or expired pharmaceuticals.
That's right.
Drugs like that at the police station.
Absolutely.
They have a receptacle there right in the lobby. So there's lots of ways you can help protect the environment, protect our watershed.
That's right.
From trash and litter and plastics and chemicals and pharmaceuticals and hazardous waste.
We've also got some events going on at Swanner on Earth Day. There is a birding basics class. So you can come if you're a beginning birder and start out with people in your... You know, we've gotten feedback that sometimes it's intimidating to work with people who know so much about birds. So this year, birding basics class.
Like you, when you're standing out there and...
Oh, believe me, I'm not an expert birder. I wish I was.
Oh.
I'm not.
I thought you said you were.
No.
Okay.
Far from it. I'm heavily dependent upon apps and ID books still at this point. I'm getting better. And there's also an Earth Day open house, so we're partnering with a handful of other local nonprofits from Park City, and actually the Wasatch Front, the Natural History Museum will be coming up, and each organization will be bringing like an activity or a lesson, leading a tour or something like that. So you'll see Summit Land Conservancy, Recycle Utah, Kimball Art Center, you know, the whole crew.
And so the Sandhill Cranes are back near where I live. The golf course?
Yeah.
Of course, it could be anywhere within 5 miles because I hear them.
Yes, but you always hear the call before you see them.
Quite a while.
They are back on the Swanner Preserve too, Chris.
And you got to have the cam
on the crane
out.
Cam. The crane cam is crane up
cam
and going.
Yep. For their chicks?
Yep.
Perfect. All right. We've got one last break and we got to wrap up. This is This Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
This Summit Community Power Works report is brought to you in part by Rocky Mountain Power.
Time to wrap things up on This Green Earth. Again, thanks to Donald Worster, environmental historian and author of the latest book, Shrinking the Earth. It's available in paperback, Oxford University Press publisher. Good book, interesting conversation, and it's good to be hopeful.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We'll stick with that. And then we also want to thank our sponsors and our underwriters who make this show possible. As always, they include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promises.
Promises, there's a lot of promises. Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and listeners like you. We always want to hear from you, your ideas, your thoughts about what kind of topics you want us to cover, what books you may have read that you think would be interesting for interviews. We're open to suggestions. It's your show. Your pledges drive this show, and we want to thank you for that, as always. But your thoughts and ideas also help drive this show. So you can do that by emailing us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. We've got your Wasatch back.
Thanks again for joining us. NPR News is coming up. No change, I can change.